Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Well, hello and welcome to the Big Change Podcast. This is Jonathan Wilson and I'm your host. The Big Change series explores how ordinary Christians can change their world. And in this series, we've been hearing from various guests about how they are taking on today, often in very thoughtful and strategic ways, the complicated and the systemic problems of our world that we face. We've explored the Bible's wisdom and truth that it allows us to understand why systems of brokenness and oppression arise, what God has done in Jesus to address those systems at their root, and the role that we can play as Christians to live that out in our own lives. And we've looked at examples from history that show us how entire societies have actually seen transformational change when Christians have been faithful to these principles and ultimately to their God, to Jesus. Now, as listeners will know, we've been working through the letter of Colossians that Paul wrote to this, at the time, tiny church back in the early days of Christianity spreading in the Roman Empire, where he talks about this theme of reconciliation, where that's God's project. He's bringing about the reconciliation of all things in heaven and earth back into proper order and into wholesome relationship with himself. What I'd like to focus on here is that in this letter, Paul says that God's universe-wide work of reconciliation encompasses great powers that are active in creation. He calls them thrones, dominions, rulers, and authorities. Now, broadly speaking, those first two terms, thrones and dominions, refer to dark, demonic powers that are invested in the success of oppressive political or other systems of influence in a culture. And those powers are in some way upholding or enabling those systems. And those powers will oppose being brought back into a properly ordered relationship with God. And because of that, Christians and others can anticipate facing stiff resistance, an aggressive hostility when engaging those systems for change. When I was in university in the UK, I was in a secular university and I was in probably the darkest possible part of the university, which is the fine arts department, where, you know, some of my people, my classmates were into the occult. Numbers of them used hard drugs to inspire their work. You know, it was an interesting place. People knew that I was a Christian. I think I didn't explicitly run, you know, I didn't run around explicitly sharing my faith all the time, but people knew who I was. And they treated me as if, well, I must be a bit dim if I believed this kind of fairy tale stuff. And more than that, as the years went by, I found that if I did something that expressed more explicitly my Christian faith, like through my work, the reaction could be extraordinary. And I remember one time doing an exhibition to my class, a presentation to my class, and all of a sudden there was this eruption of anger. I thought I was presenting something beautiful and good. And the reaction I got was vitriolic. Like literally there were about 15 or 20 classmates shouting at me from across a table. And it got so heated that my non-Christian friends started to shout back. And so in a sense, you know, I mean, these are people, but I think that illustrated that there are other powers at work that want to hold people in their in these places. And when light comes in, they react. Now, the second of these two terms, rulers and authorities, refers to the socio-political systems, the systems of rule or order or ideology that are intrinsic to our cultures. We tend to either fear these or to revere them for their power. We look to them to bring us the solutions that we want in our lives. So these aren't just political authorities, but other kinds too. The authority of large corporations, the authority of power and the power of economic systems, power of ideologies, the power of large organizations, power of tech, the power of science, and on and on. So these are two sets of authorities that God is ultimately calling to come back into relationship with himself. And in the last number of decades, in Western society especially, there's one particular power or authority that I think is worth focused attention. That's the ideological system of secularism that has governed our culture, which claims to derive its authority chiefly from reason and from science. And the last 200 years of Western history appear to demonstrate the power of this worldview. the power of secular and materialistic views has actually, in Western thinking, triumphed over Christianity, triumphed over other religions and superstition. So with me today is a guest who can speak to all of that. And that's Justin Brierley. Justin Brierley is from the UK, and he has gained a great deal of respect for his radio and podcast show, Unbelievable. And with that has come a large following behind Justin, people who are Christians, atheists, and everybody in between, who followed what he's doing because of how skillfully he's brought Christians and non-Christians together into really constructive and productive conversations across sometimes very deep differences. And then most recently, Justin has been rolling out a documentary podcast series called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, which has also been doing really well. So all this has meant that for years now, Justin has been tracking the project of the secular. And when he began, it was a new atheist who were in full swing. But now he's seen change happening. And it's that conversation that we want to have with Justin to hear what he's been seeing. So Justin, welcome to the Big Change podcast. I'm really looking forward to our time together.
Oh, thank you, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm looking forward to the conversation too.
But let me share a bit of your biography. Until 2023, Justin was theology and apologetics editor for Premier Christian Radio in the UK, which is where he hosted the Unbelievable show. And he was also editor of their magazine for a number of years. Justin's an author, and he's written books that have been really well received, that being a book called Unbelievable after his show, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, and then his latest book, which shapes the conversation today, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. So I've described a little bit of what you've been seeing. Please give us a bit more detail. Tell us your story. Tell us what shifts you've been noticing.
Yeah, well, the new book and the new podcast series, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, has a sort of subtitle to it, which is Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. And that, in a nutshell, is my thesis, really. In the time when I began the Unbelievable show, bringing Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, it was very much in the heyday of what was the new atheism. This was the mid-2000s. When there were these best-selling anti-God books by people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris. And there was just a lot of popular stuff going on around the atheist movement, a lot of column inches, a lot of TV shows. This was the sort of the start of the internet and social media. So a lot of atheists were finding each other in those online spaces, starting to kind of get together. And it was also in the wake of 9/11, that was a significant factor in kind of making this movement feel like, hey, it's time to, you know, put our perspective forward. Religion has had its day. So it ended up with things like, you know, in London where I live, you know, we had the atheist bus campaign that was sort of red London buses circulating the capital, bearing the slogan, there's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. So it was a really kind of in your face, full on, quite dogmatic, quite aggressive form of atheism. In a way, that was a gift to me, starting this discussion show, because it gave a really interesting kind of perspective to engage with. So a lot of the guests I had in those early days were these quite dogmatic, aggressive, new atheist type of speakers, opposite Christian thinkers like, you know, William Lane Craig and N.T. Wright and others. What I did notice, though, was that over the years, the tone of the conversation started to change. More and more people that I were bringing on who weren't believers were saying, well, I'm not a Richard Dawkins kind of atheist. They were. I think there was a sense that the public started to see that the new atheism itself was almost quite fundamentalist and quasi-religious in itself, just how zealous, you know, the people were behind it, just how anti-religious they were and so on. And I think that started to grate with a certain number of people. I think in the end, people just didn't find that the answers they offered actually sort of were really existentially very helpful. You know, science is great for some things, but it won't necessarily build you a meaningful life. And beyond all that, and this is something I spell out in some detail in the book and podcast series, that the new atheism itself kind of suffered an internal meltdown, because once the lead architects had agreed that God didn't exist and religion was bad for you, they really couldn't agree on much else after that, because they started to have huge fallouts over the kind of hot button kind of culture war issues that are so common now, but things like feminism, LGBT, those kinds of things. And it really started to produce some big cracks in their edifice. Eventually, it led to things like Richard Dawkins having his Humanist of the Year award stripped of him by the American Humanist Association because of, you know, his statements on transgender. It led to the cancellation of atheist conferences because the speakers just wouldn't get up on a stage next to each other. So the whole thing kind of had this quite dramatic implosion as well. And that's just another interesting facet of it. But beyond all of that, there was just this real sense that the conversation moved on, frankly. And now, looking back, New Atheism kind of feels a bit passé. What I did notice happening in the sort of wake of the New Atheism starting to fizzle out was that a lot of secular, non-Christian people were coming on my show, having conversations, but it was very different in tone. These were people who were far more open to the value of Christianity. They weren't nearly as dismissive of the value of faith. These were people like Jordan Peterson, the Canadian psychologist, who, while he wouldn't necessarily call himself a Christian, was nevertheless extolling the values of the Bible, the Christian heritage, the idea that to make sense of ourselves as humans, we needed to understand ourselves as being made in the image of God. So there were lots of new conversations that I noticed happening. And a lot of these were very significant individuals drawing large audiences, filling stadiums, in fact, for their lectures and so on. And they were drawing the same kind of demographic, especially young men, away from the new atheists and to this new way of thinking about God. And I just noticed over time a real change in the atmosphere in that way. And it was actually in a conversation with one of these sort of secular intellectuals called Douglas Murray, who's quite a well-known sort of thinker, quite sort of on the right politically, but sort of describes himself as a Christian atheist because he understands that while he doesn't believe in Christianity, he's still absolutely shaped by the Christian worldview that he has inherited, if you like. And he said to me during a conversation, well, the thing about the sea of faith, quoting this famous line by the Victorian poet Matthew Arnold, who talks about the melancholy, long withdrawing roar of the sea of faith. He said, the thing about the sea of faith, Justin, is it doesn't just go out. It could come back in again. That's the point of tides. And he was noticing himself, you know, a surprising number of his own contemporaries who were reconsidering Christianity, who were even converting to Christianity. And it just made me think maybe we're reaching a point where this secular material story of reality is starting to reach its furthest limit. Maybe we're just starting to see people reconsidering the Christian story. Maybe our culture's got to a point where, as they've tried one story for long enough, the secular material story of reality, and it's failed to deliver, people are opening up to the possibility that actually there may be something in this old story, Christianity, that once shaped so many people's lives. And it's not that our churches are suddenly bursting at the seams or anything like that. All I'm pointing out really is a real change in the way people are talking about God, talking about faith, to say 10 or 15 years ago.
Just to comment on Peterson and his impact, I had a good friend or have a good friend who was a colleague when I was in management consulting who was quite open about his atheism, not hostile to me or my faith. And then one day he told me about the impact of Peterson, Jordan Peterson, on him, and how Peterson's call to his listeners that they should behave at least as if God exists, because then that will inform better, you know, better behavior. My atheist friend was taking that very seriously. So, you know, that, yeah, if there's a tide creating a shift, that's an example of it.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, some of these characters, and Jordan Peterson is just one among many I cover in the book, even if they're not, it's not entirely clear where they are on their own journey of faith, you know, and I asked this question of Peterson when he came on my show, you know, do you believe in God? And he gave his classic answer, well, it depends what you mean by God. But wherever they find themselves, what I do know is that, as you've said, they're kind of opening the door for other people to explore Christianity. It's become a kind of intellectual option again. And I've seen a lot of people walk through that door. I know people who have become, you know, fully signed up Christians because they were kind of given the permission to look into it again. So I do feel like something is changing. As I say, it's not a flood at this point, but I think it's that turning of the tide. And who knows, you know, it could turn into quite a strong tide coming back again.
Yeah. So what you're describing is a situation where the secular project is not a final stage in human evolution. It's brought an end to all the nonsense before it, but rather it's been a phase in human and cultural development. And the shift seems to be revealing cracks in this edifice of secularism. I'm curious what you think might be the core problem that is being surfaced in this shift that you're seeing.
One of the key things that I've noticed is what a lot of psychologists are calling the emergence of a meaning crisis in our culture. And I think this is largely because we've lost the story that once collectively made sense of our common identity and purpose and sense of meaning. And it was the Christian story. So for thousands of years, essentially in the West, that has predominantly shaped the way we think about ourselves and the universe and our place in it. And it's a story with sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, we were created in the image of God. Yes, we experience this life. It's full of often pain and trial and suffering, but we believe in a God who came in to experience that with us and gives us the hope of eternal life. And there's a sort of a glorious sort of redemption and resurrection and the hope of all things in the future, you know, just in that, as you quote in that passage from Colossians earlier. So there's a sense in which people, whether they kind of realized it consciously or not, they were kind of living within a story that helped to make sense of their life. The problem is, as that story has gone, as it's sort of gone into the back mirror, and the new atheists essentially were kind of doing their best to sweep that away from the public stage as far as possible. The question is, well, what's replaced it? And I think very naively, the new atheists thought that it would be replaced by some utopia of science and reason. And it just hasn't been replaced by that. It's actually been replaced by all kinds of other stories, because we are story-driven creatures. We need a story to make sense of our life. The problem is, when we don't have that story, we'll replace it with another story. And these stories are very often insubstantial, and then they're not meant to take the place of God. We're replacing them with things that effectively become idols. And so it's often political ideologies that become people's new sacred story. It could be a gender and sexuality perspective. It could be, believing that certain political savior figures are our great hope. Whatever it is, they're not necessarily bad in and of themselves, but they're not meant to take the place of God. But these stories bump up against each other, and they create these culture wars. And so we live in this very tribalistic, fragmented culture now. And it's because I think we've lost that story. And I think increasingly we're seeing this manifested now in the mental health crisis, for instance, among young people, not having a story that makes sense of your life. This emerging meaning crisis, I think, is driving. And it's only being accelerated by social media and technology and everything else. But it's driving this mental health crisis, which ultimately I think is, for many people, an identity crisis. You know, who am I? What am I doing in the world? Who am I supposed to be? I think these are all conditions, if you like, that have been created by this secular materialist story of reality that's come to dominate our culture, which doesn't have a story. In fact, it's a non-story. It's a kind of, well, there is no overarching purpose or meaning or identity. You kind of have to make it up. And so I think that's one of the major problems that the secular kind of revolution has brought in its wake, is this sense of purposelessness, if you like.
You and I have both seen that remarkable conversation between Ayaan Hirsi Ali and Richard Dawkins recently. I thought that surfaced something very profound. Maybe you could speak to that, because you've been tracking that story. So,
yeah, well, just to give a bit of background to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, she is a remarkable woman. She was a Somali-born Muslim and was raised or got involved in a very sort of extremist form of Islam, but escaped it after fleeing a sort of forced marriage, ended up in the Netherlands and became a very convinced atheist. In fact, she became part of the new atheist movement in due course. She was supposed to be the fifth horsewoman of the four horsemen of the new atheism, in fact. And she shared stages, you know, with Harris and Dawkins and Hitchens. She still counts Dawkins as a very good friend. And so what was remarkable about this dialogue they shared recently in New York is that she wasn't coming on as an atheist any longer. She was coming on as a Christian. And this is the remarkable thing. Ayaan Hirsi Ali published in November 2023 a remarkable essay on the Unheard website titled "Why I Am Now a Christian," detailing why she had now embraced Christianity. And this is like, in the atheist world of atheism, this is a bit like a Paul on the road to Damascus moment. This is like big news when someone of her stature and influence says she's now become a Christian. And it was very interesting, because it was, in some ways, a lot of the things I've just described were there in that essay. She was talking about the way she believes that actually Christianity is kind of always been the foundation of the West. And when you take it away, what are you left with? And the fact that, as far as she could see, atheist materialism just could not do the job of giving people the meaning and purpose they need to sustain the values that we cherish in Western culture. There was a kind of political dimension to her story, but also she talked about a personal kind of meaning crisis. She said, I couldn't make sense of life on an atheistic worldview. And in subsequent interviews, she talked very candidly and movingly about her own sort of depression that she was going through a number of psychiatrists and therapists and trying to self-medicate with alcohol. But what in the end changed things was when one of her therapists said, have you thought about prayer? Because I think you're spiritually bankrupt. And she said, well, I can't pray to God. The God I was raised with was a monster. And this therapist said, well, what kind of God could you pray to, do you think? And she started to describe the kind of God she could possibly believe in. And she realized as she was doing that, that she was describing Jesus. And so she thought, well, maybe I don't need to invent a new God. Maybe I should look into this one. And she started to pray, to go to church. And she says it has completely transformed her life. So she's a Christian now. And that, again, as I said, Dawkins himself found this completely perplexing. Because he could not understand why she had suddenly made this radical change of mind. And he thought, oh, it must just be, you know, politically, you know, helpful, socially useful kind of quote unquote conversion. You're not really a Christian, I am. But actually, the first thing she said as they went on stage together was she talked about how at a personal level, this had changed her life, why she believes in God now.
Yeah. And I thought when she had that public conversation with Richard Dawkins, it was quite remarkable because they're obviously friends and she spoke very graciously to him, but she also spoke very clearly and firmly. And she made a remarkable comment that the atheism that he holds to actually offers quite literally nothing. And she was making more than a casual point. She was making a philosophical point. It quite literally offers nothing. And it reminded me of back when I lived in Canada and talking with my colleagues and saying, you know, I grew up in a tribal culture where telling myths and legends was really key to holding the culture together. These, like you say, these large stories that tell us who we are and why we're here. And in Western culture, the story that I continuously used to hear is a story of evolution. But that's the story of mechanics. It's not a story with a plot. It's not a story with, you know, redemption in it. It doesn't go anywhere. I mean, I think we make it go somewhere. We believe that evolution leads to higher and higher outcomes, but that's a thesis. So yeah, he didn't really seem to be able to respond to that. Instead, he had to keep returning to beliefs that she holds that in his view are just absurd and fantastical, like Jesus being born to a virgin or something like that. So you've seen these remarkable changes unfolding over these years. You've watched them very closely in your role as a kind of journalist and podcaster. The first one that I've picked up on is this idea that there is this inherent incompatibility and actually antagonism between science and religion, and that science has the only reliable truth. So I'd love to hear you know, what have you seen people saying about that who weren't Christians or even aren't Christians, but are creating a shift in this understanding of this idea?
Yeah, and it's instructive that a lot of the new atheist sort of speakers and architects were scientists themselves, Richard Dawkins being the obvious example. And so they often used science as this measure of truth, the only way we can know things, and essentially as a sort of stick to beat people of faith with, because, well, faith is just about feelings and, you know, it's not objective in the way that science is and so on. I mean, in reality, if you go and look at how science is actually done, you'll find that it's pretty subjective as well in lots of different ways. So there's a kind of another story to be told there. But having said all that, I think a lot of people these days are just waking up to the fact that science is really good for some things, you know, working out the orbits of the planets and, you know, how to make, you know, the physics work for a plane to fly, those sorts of things. Great. Science is the tool you want for that. But it's not the tool for all kinds of knowledge. And that was the big mistake, I think, of the new atheists, is they assumed it could be used for everything, and it simply can't be. It's not designed for that. There are all kinds of truths that fall outside of the purview of science. There's moral truth, for a start. You know, how do we decide what is right or wrong? I mean, science can show you how to split the atom, but it's not necessarily going to tell you how you should use that technology. That's going to come from somewhere else in the end, for some great good purpose, like nuclear energy, or from some really bad purpose, like a nuclear bomb. So there's there's all kinds of things, and that's just one example, morality, where science isn't going to tell you the way you should do things. There's art, there's ethics, there's beauty, there's all kinds of lots of things that you could say are subjective at one level, but actually I think we're looking for a way to understand them in an objective way, and we're not going to find that through science necessarily. One person I think who's really been interesting in this area, and again, not coming specifically from a Christian point of view, one of these secular voices that I talk about in my book and podcast, is Ian McGilchrist, who's a psychiatrist and philosopher by background. But he's a real expert on the brain specifically, and the fact that we are split into two hemispheres, the left and the right. And he's got an amazing sort of thesis that's really kind of been very influential since he wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary, that actually, historically speaking, the left and the right hemispheres kind of have done different things. The left hemisphere has tended to be about breaking down the world into its constituent parts, gathering individual discrete pieces of data to kind of analyze, if you like, and look at. And the right hemisphere has always been about making sense in a bigger way, in a bigger picture way, of that data. And so on a very kind of simplistic level, often we talk about left and right brain people, you know, the lefty types being more the kind of scientists and logicians, and the right being more the artistic types. And that kind of maybe helps to see it. It's a little bit of a broad brush way of looking at it. But essentially, the idea is that actually the two hemispheres absolutely work together. But the idea is that the right hemisphere is supposed to be the dominant partner, the master, if you like, in Ian McGilchrist's book, because they take the things that the left hemisphere brings them, the emissary, you know, kind of going and gathering stuff from the world, and then they make sense of it in a bigger sense. And that includes our intuition, our sense of the bigness of the world, what's going on out there, all the other things. It's a holistic way of understanding the world. And Ian McGilchrist says the problem is that our culture today has inverted that relationship. So we're now a left hemisphere dominated culture, in which we kind of prefer the way in which the left hemisphere does everything. And we think that's how to understand the world, by dividing it all up into its constituent parts. And we've kind of sidelined the idea of the intuition and imagination and, frankly, spirituality and God. That's kind of all the domain, if you like, of the right hemisphere, in favor of just seeing the world purely in its constituent parts, and that you can break everything down to its fundamental atoms, you've kind of understood it. And this, he says, has been absolutely terrible for our culture, because it kind of puts you on a collision course to this meaning crisis. Because if you end up seeing the world in that way, you really don't understand the world you're living in. You just don't get it. And so he has been really advocating for a return to kind of ways of engaging that right hemispheric way of putting those pieces together. He's saying science is absolutely important. You know, we need that left hemispheric way of thinking to kind of be able to do that data analysis. But that's not it. That's not the way the world is. That's just one way of kind of understanding the world. It's the right hemispheric way, in which we put all that together in a bigger story of relationships, of faith, of imagination, that all actually ultimately makes sense. And so he's really advocating for a return to a much more holistic way of understanding our world. I think people are now starting to see that people like McGilchrist have something really important to offer. This idea that science can do everything is just simply not true, and that actually there is a really important role, actually far more important than science, for God, essentially, in our culture. That's the way in which we'll truly understand who we are and what we're here for.
I think that's quite important, because it's not just to a belief system, like a new set of beliefs, that would still be sticking us in the left brain space, but to God himself, to a person. So the second myth, or in a sense, questionable viewpoint that we want to talk about today, is this idea that the worldview and the ethical foundations of the West that have made it what it has been over these last couple hundred years are a product of the Enlightenment. They are the result of a rationalist breaking out of the Dark Ages. You've encountered some very important thinkers in this area. In fact, you're close friends, I believe, with Tom Holland, and have had many interactions with him along the way. He's a key thinker in this area. Perhaps you could just speak to this as well, this false idea of the Enlightenment shaping our time.
Yeah, and the Tom Holland you refer to there, not the Spider-Man Marvel actor, but the historian Tom Holland is worth saying. Tom Holland is a remarkable person. He is a popular historian. He's written a number of books about the Greco-Roman world. He now hosts probably the most popular history podcast in the world, The Rest Is History. So he has a massive platform, but he's gone on a really interesting journey, and it's really spelled out over 600 plus pages in his book Dominion, which is all about the way the Christian Revolution has shaped the moral instincts of the West. And, you know, you say quite rightly, a lot of people just assume that the moral sort of waters we swim in are a result of science, the Enlightenment, reason, and so on. And his book just shows that is not the case. It's interesting because in a way, this is a personal story for Tom Holland. He was raised in a kind of nominal Christian kind of environment, but whatever faith he had sort of sputtered out by his teenage years. And then after university, he started this project of writing on popular history. And as he entered and researched the world of the Greeks and the Romans, he was fascinated by it. You know, it was very exciting and sort of glamorous world. But he was also appalled by it as well, because the values they held were so different to his own. You know, this was a world where slavery was just a de facto part of the economy. No one questioned it. A world where the lives of women and children were cheap. A world where some people could be the sexual property of others. You know, noble Roman men were basically allowed access to whoever they wanted, you know, who was their social inferior. A world where, you know, the slaughter and enslavement of a million people was a cause for triumph for Caesar, you know, not genocide. And he just realized how very, very different this world was to his own. And the fact that he believed in equality, dignity, human rights, progress, freedom, he realized in the end, those values had to have come from somewhere. They certainly weren't the values of the Greco-Roman world. Where did they come from? And he realized they didn't come from science or the Enlightenment or atheism. He realized they came from Jesus of Nazareth, that this man who began this revolution 2000 years ago had, through his followers and the church, completely reshaped the way the Western world thinks about how to be human, what it means. So completely, in fact, that we don't even think about it anymore. The waters, as he puts it, the waters we swim in are so Christian. We're like a goldfish in a bowl who, you know, another goldfish swims up to them and says, "How's the water?" And the goldfish says, "What water?" It's like we don't realize how completely shaped we are by Christian assumptions. So, of course, we believe in human rights now. Who wouldn't believe in human rights? But actually, as Tom says, that's a completely theological assumption, you know. And there have been lots of cultures historically that have not believed in that. There are still cultures today that don't believe in that. Where did this belief come from? It came from the idea that you're made in the image of God. And the Christian Revolution was what essentially globalized that belief. So Tom Holland's a hugely interesting character because he has just, to such a wide audience, popularized this idea that actually all of your ethical beliefs that you hold to so firmly, especially in the West, they came from somewhere and they came from Christianity. And that's been a real stone in the shoe, a sort of thorn in the side, if you like, for a lot of his atheist secular peers who would like their morality to somehow just be the product of pure reason and science. But it just isn't. And I think he's shown very convincingly historically that our values are very contingent on the Christian worldview. Now, the question he's asking after that is, well, what happens when we lose the Christian story? Can we continue to have the fruits, if you like, without the roots? And that's what a lot of these secular thinkers are now asking. What do we do in the absence of this Christian story?
If you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please review this episode to help shape future content on Reframed.
So, Justin, there's one other thinker, again, secular thinker, not a Christian, who's also been making waves in recent years in probably one of the most contested spaces in our culture today, which is around sexuality. That's Louise Perry. She's also representing this kind of shift you're talking about. Do you want to tell us a bit about her?
Yeah. Fascinating individual who's really come to prominence in the last few years for writing a book called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. Louise Perry, in many ways, was schooled in typical kind of Western liberal thought around feminism, sexuality, relationships, very much a product of the 60s sexual revolution in that sense. But it was actually working in a rape crisis center after university that led her to completely start to rethink relationships and sex. And she wrote this book basically critiquing the way in which the sexual revolution had been very good for some people, men primarily, but not good for women and children in all kinds of ways. And she wrote it purely kind of at a socio-evolutionary level. She doesn't have a faith. She certainly wasn't writing it from a Christian perspective. But she came in the process of writing that book to very Christian conclusions ethically, because what she discovered was that there was an institution which for centuries had kind of put guardrails on especially male sexuality and enabled the flourishing of families and whole cultures in the process. And that was this funny old institution called Christian monogamous marriage. And she basically wrote a book saying maybe we need to rethink this complete liberalization of sex in our culture, this idea that it's all just about freedom and consent, basically. Actually, there's a lot of other things that go into a flourishing culture, family, and sexual relationships. So she's kind of, in a funny way, come to be quite an advocate for a far more traditional way of looking at family and relationships, even without necessarily having come there from a Christian point of view. I mean, it's worth saying, actually, that both Louise Perry and Tom Holland, nevertheless, in my personal interactions with them, have talked about how attractive they find the Christian worldview. So I don't think it's any accident that they've kind of come to intellectual conclusions about the value of Christianity, and they've begun to start to ask, well, maybe there's something to this in reality as well. Maybe it's not just a happy coincidence that Christianity happens to produce these beneficial outcomes. And so I think, you know, they're going on a journey. Who knows exactly where that'll go for them both. But nonetheless, it's, again, she's another great example of the way in which I see the secular material project, which just says, do what you want, be who you want, as long as you're not hurting anyone else, everything's up for grabs. She sees how thin a story that is. It's not a story that actually makes sense of the fullness of who we are and what we're meant to be. And so I, again, she's just another very interesting secular thinker saying, maybe this story of Christianity has something to offer. Maybe we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And yeah, just a fascinating individual.
Which brings us really to, in a sense, to the rub, which is Jesus himself. And in a sense, this myth or this idea that his historicity is at best a question mark. And the idea of his resurrection in particular is just sheer fairy tale stuff. You've got probably decades of podcasts on The Unbelievable Show dealing with this, and people can go there to hear those arguments. But again, looking at the shifts that have been occurring and people thinking about this, that would be interesting to hear as well. People like Tom Holland, people like Martin Shaw.
Yeah, there's definitely been a change in the atmosphere as a whole about the value of the Bible, you know, as a literary source. I mean, even dyed-in-the-wool atheists like Richard Dawkins have still had to admit of the great literary, you know, value and tradition that's come from things like the King James version of the Bible and so on. He even, you know, sponsored having a King James version of the Bible in every school in the UK just on the basis of that. So even atheists will admit to the fact that there is this incredibly important literary aspect to the Bible in the West. Having said that, you know, Dawkins will still say, but the things it actually says and claims are ridiculous and so on, fairy tales and everything else. Again, this is an area where I've seen an increasing pushback, even in secular circles, as people, A, have taken what's being said in the Bible more seriously. And now that may be at a sort of psychological, symbolic level, when you've got, you know, the aforementioned Jordan Peterson drawing thousands of young men to tell them about just how deep and important the wisdom of scripture is. And other secular psychologists like Jonathan Haidt writing books about just how important those stories are, how deep they go, and so on. There's kind of a reappreciation of the value of these ancient stories, and I think a move against what, you know, C.S. Lewis termed chronological snobbery, the idea that only the most up-to-date stories and ideas are the ones worth thinking about and learning from. Actually, yes, the ancients didn't necessarily know all the science we know, but they weren't stupid people. They had deep insights. They had really important things to say. And I think we're seeing a return to that, even if you look on a lot of the popular influencers of our day, the kind of popular YouTube channels and accounts. A lot of them are returning to ancient things like Stoicism as a source of meaning and so on. But I think that's also being captured actually by the Tom Hollands and so on. So showing people that, and the Jordan Petersons, so showing people that there's a lot to be found in the Bible, as it turns out, that it's not all just, you know, Bronze Age goat herders, as you know, Dawkins once said. So there's that. There's the kind of the wisdom that's there. But then at a historical level, increasingly, actually, in the 20th and 21st century, there's been so much work that has started to show that actually there's a very historical, credible core to both the Old and the New Testament. I mean, on the New Testament, we now have a wealth of resources that we never had 100, 150 years ago for showing just how reliable the gospel texts are, for instance. You know, when you look at it compared to any other ancient literature, equivalent literature of the time, it is miles ahead in terms of the number of copies we have, how close they are to the events, the number of sources. It's like a gold mine when you compare it to other equivalent ancient sources. And so this idea that floats around in common culture, oh, it's all just fairy tales and so on, you know, just word of mouth, the telephone game, whatever. It's not true. We have better evidence for the life and death of Jesus Christ than pretty much any other event in ancient history. And on top of that, I think the resurrection, yeah, obviously that is a miraculous claim. And that kind of goes to the core of the problem, that we live in a culture where supernatural claims, miraculous claims are just kind of out of bounds in our kind of materialistic, scientistic kind of framework. But if you're willing to just question that framework, what you'll actually find is that the historical sort of circumstances and material surrounding the claims of the resurrection are actually incredibly compelling if you're open to the idea that those first followers, what they claimed had happened to their Jewish Messiah, had actually happened. And so I found actually the more I look at this story, the more it does make compelling sense. And I found sort of one remarkable person I spoke to a year or so ago was a woman called Molly Worthen, who is a professor of religious history at the University of North Carolina. And for pretty much all of her academic career, the past 20 years or so, has been a sort of agnostic, interested in Christianity, reporting on it, reporting on the good, the bad, and the ugly, actually, of American Christianity. But it was only when she was challenged by someone she'd been asked to do a profile on for the Atlantic magazine, a pastor called J.D. Greer, it was only when he challenged her to get off the agnostic fence and actually look into the historical claims of Jesus Christ and the manuscript evidence and everything, that she went away and did that homework. And he put her in touch with some pretty influential historians like N.T. Wright and Christian thinkers like Tim Keller at the time. So she was, you know, kind of going right to the top when it came to the people she was emailing and having the conversations with. But what she discovered, as she told it to me, was far more interesting and compelling evidence than she'd realized was there, that something had happened 2,000 years ago. And that actually led to her committing her life and becoming baptized, completely, as I say, against all her expectations. So there's something going on. Again, she's just one more example of what I'd call this surprising rebirth, these unlikely converts, adult converts to Christianity. Because she realized not only did the Bible kind of make sense of her at a kind of existential level, it also, funnily enough, made sense at a historical level. And I just keep bumping into those stories again. It does make me feel, again, like the tide's turning, something's happening where people are just starting to question that completely materialist, scientistic narrative and saying, well, what if we could allow a God a foot in the door? How would we look at history differently then?
Yeah. And one of the things that strikes me is that as more and more historians are saying that what the narrative that we see in the Gospels, the life of Jesus that we see spelt out, including the empty tomb, we need to take that literally. That's what happened. Because of those presuppositions that you've been talking about, they won't go any further than that and say, well, why is the tomb, or why was the tomb empty? And I think this is where the Christian testimony or the testimony of Scripture, it pushes us into a corner where we actually have to start to address, why is it that I'm not prepared to answer that question? And it's not because there's no answer. It's because I'm not prepared to accept the answer, because it jars so deeply with my commitment against an intervention of that kind, you know, that God would raise a man from the dead. And of course, as you become a Christian and you explore it, it makes incredible sense that Jesus is randomly, you know, raised from the dead. That he's being raised from the dead as an explicit demonstration that God has overcome death, and in doing so, overcome evil, because evil is able to use death against us because of our sin. So it's really quite profound. I actually heard Jordan Peterson years ago, before he became a well-known person, speaking at a conference, this would have been around 2006, and he said back then, I have never encountered anything with as many metaphysical layers as Christianity. Just another comment, you know, one of the other myths, and you've touched on it, is this idea that the Bible is an ignorant text, reflecting the ignorance of its time, which, you know, Dawkins loves to play on that idea. Just a quick comment from my side is, you know, as somebody has done a lot of work within the biblical text, I working with the Hebrew Old Testament, apart from Shakespeare, I don't know if I can think of anything that is so literarily sophisticated and complex. The Gospel of John is another one in the New Testament. Like, it's inescapable. You'd almost think it's impossible. Somebody had to have had a computer at hand to be able to hold all the pieces together before they finally assembled them. They're so rich in how they interplay and interconnect. So just on that level alone, I think Dawkins is right about the literary skill that you see in scripture and the richness of it. But of course, we're talking about a great deal more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the fascinating people that I've met in the last couple of years, who has his own surprising story of rebirth, is Martin Shaw, who's a mythologist and storyteller by background. And he was raised in a Christian environment, but sort of essentially rejected it because it, in many ways, partly because it felt too tame, if you like. He kind of was raised in an environment where it had very much been domesticated, as he puts it. And he was kind of he's always been a bit of a wild man of the woods kind of character. And so he has lived much of his life in this mode of being a sort of a traveling bard, storyteller, teaching on these things, interacting with lots of different communities around the world and their mythologies and stories and so on. And so he's very much one of those people who sees the way that story and myth shape us, you know, as human beings, and how we can't live without that, you know, that sense of who we are. But he's got this most fascinating story himself of only a couple of years ago, actually, on a kind of wilderness retreat that he set himself, having this extraordinary encounter with what he describes as a kind of a vision of a painted arrow coming out of the sky on the very final night of his wilderness retreat. And kind of landing in front of him and just this extraordinary thing that he felt was God speaking to him in a very direct way. And he started to have dreams about Jesus. He started to experience this call to Christian faith. And again, he said he was not expecting this to be the way his life was going to go, but he kind of leaned into it. And he found actually in the end that the Jesus he discovered when he went back to the Gospels was absolutely made sense of that journey he'd been on, looking at all of the myths and stories that we've told ourselves and different cultures tell themselves. He kind of had a very C.S. Lewis-like conversion in that sense, where he saw that actually the real historical person of Jesus, that he has a great phrase about, the thing about the story of Jesus is that it comes with a postcode. You know, this is real historical events, flesh and blood. Something happened in a real time and place in the Middle East. And he says, but it's a story that encompasses and makes sense of all of those other stories because this story has flesh and bones on it. It's the true myth, as C.S. Lewis put it. It's been inconvenient in some ways to him because, you know, he was friends with a lot of people all over the world from different religious backgrounds, communities, who suddenly feel like, well, Martin, now you've decided to kind of throw your lot in with a very specific story, the Christian story, and that doesn't always go down well. But actually, he said, no, this is the story that makes sense of all those other stories.
He's a lovely fellow in the way he interviews. Very, obviously, very scholarly, but very warm and self-effacing and humorous. So, Justin, the final kind of myth that I thought would be helpful for us to look at today is this idea that at root, the secularism-Christianity conflict is really nothing more than a contest of two human belief systems, and one is better than the other because the one is just, like you say, it's out of date. It's based on fairy tales at best. The other is based on science and reason, and of course is therefore superior. But firstly, let's return to that criticism that we've been hearing, which is that a lot of these folk like Douglas Murray, Tom Holland, you know, Douglas Murray says, I'm an atheist Christian, or however he expresses that, Tom Holland, Jordan Peterson, and so on, they haven't made the jump, but they uphold the importance of the Christian faith or a belief system. That has been kind of challenged as a bit of a cynical move. It's a political move to try and hold on to things that we're in danger of losing. And so they're not going to jump all the way in. And that tells us something. Before we move into the transformational stories, what do you think are the truths of that critique and the limitations of that critique?
Yeah, I think there is some truth to that critique. I've got a friend, Alex O'Connor, who's quite a well-known YouTube atheist and thinker. And this is his main critique of my thesis when we've had conversations about this, that actually he thinks this is really primarily a political thing. I think you have absolutely got some of those characters who are kind of, as I say, just seeing religion as a useful fiction that we can hopefully get, you know, use for some sort of political purpose. And I think they're maybe at one end of the spectrum, if you like. But I also see people who are kind of somewhere in the middle, who absolutely see the value of religion, you know, socially useful, but they're also very intensely attracted to it. And I would put people like Tom Holland and Jordan Peterson into that camp. And they're almost at times seem to be teetering on the very edge of belief. I mean, we can never say exactly where people are. Obviously, that's between them and God. But you know, the last conversation I had with Tom Holland in a public setting, he talked very openly and candidly about some spiritual experiences he'd had, an apparent healing after prayer, for instance, where it felt like something had shifted. It wasn't just a purely intellectual, cultural sort of thing that made him attracted to Christianity. I think there's something deeper than that going on often. And yeah, and what's holding some of these folk back from jumping all the way in? I'm not a good psychologist, but I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of motivations for why people do or don't feel able to jump in. And then you've got, I think, people who have jumped in, you know, to the stream. They absolutely see the value of Christianity, but they absolutely see that the only way this has made a difference is because it's true, that there's something that is pushing this whole idea forward. And it's this claim that a man, Jesus Christ, was raised from the dead and absolutely transformed the world through the power of the Holy Spirit in his followers. And I would put Paul Kingsnorth in that camp, fascinating individual who, again, has had a remarkable transformation in the last few years as an adult convert to Christianity. So Paul Kingsnorth here in the UK is a celebrated poet and author. And he, you know, has been in journalism and environmental activism in the past in his life as well. Really, you know, widely respected public intellectual in that sense. But he's gone through a really interesting kind of spiritual evolution over his life. He told me about how he had kind of developed a kind of teenage atheism, you know, where he kind of rejected all the kind of the rainbow strap sandal wearing vicars of his youth who tried to make Jesus look trendy at a secondary school kind of thing, and kind of just thought, oh, it's all just, you know, nonsense. It's just to make you feel better about life. So he had a spell as a sort of teenage atheist. And then he says he sort of abandoned that because he still felt there was something more. He really loved nature. He was like brought up in the woods and the wilds and loved being in nature. And so he was looking for something more transcendent. So for many, many years, he was a Buddhist. He kind of tapped into that because it was a sort of a worldview that didn't demand, if you like, a deity, but it kind of gave you a sense of spirituality as well. And so he looked sort of internally in that sense. And he said there were definite benefits to that in terms of the mindfulness and meditation that comes with that tradition. But he said he still, ultimately, he realized he wanted to worship something. And so believe it or not, he spent several years then in Wicca. He adopted this kind of what he eventually realized was a sort of pastiche of Christian heresies and New Age esoteric kind of 60s sort of pastiche of religion, but basically involved going into the woods and sort of worshiping nature. And he said it was kind of fun and interesting and different. But again, in the end, he saw that it wasn't what it claimed to be on the tin. And in the process, he also started to have some remarkable experiences. So one day over dinner, quite out of the blue, his wife, who is not a Christian, suddenly said to him, "You're going to become a Christian." And he said, "What are you talking about? Don't be ridiculous," kind of thing. But then he started to get lots of letters and engagement from his audience. Turned out a lot of them were Christians and started to, you know, come out of the woodwork, vicars who asked him to look at their sermons and things. And he thought, this is interesting, a bit strange. And then he started to have dreams about Jesus. And suddenly he felt, he says, like he was being chased. And he says he eventually got dragged kicking and screaming out of Wicca and into Christianity. And he said what he discovered there, rather like Martin Shaw, was not the Christianity he'd kind of rejected in his youth. He found something far deeper and more meaningful, a story of reality that made sense of all the stories he'd been looking for, all the stories he'd been writing over his life. It all suddenly made sense when he suddenly encountered the truth of Jesus. And now, interestingly, both he and Martin Shaw have both gone into a very ancient stream of the church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, because they've both said to me they found that that's been where they found their spiritual home, because it has this very deep mystical connection with the Christian story. It's not, in a sense, a kind of Protestant rational, let's spell everything out and kind of get it all nailed down. It keeps Christianity, as they put it, wild, if you like. There's a sort of sense in which it's still ineffable. And the whole idea, as I understand it, of the Eastern Orthodox liturgy is to kind of bring you into a space that is all about the sight and sense and touch and experience, if you like. And for them, that works really well, because that's what they've been looking for. They've been looking for something otherworldly. They've been looking for something they can experience in that way that's just different to the kind of secular material world where everything can be nailed down into, you know, brain chemistry and synapses firing and so on. And they've just found that this makes sense of them.
And for those who maybe don't know the Eastern Orthodox tradition, when Justin says it's, you know, a place where the Christian faith can remain in a sense in its wild form, we're not talking about a lack of specificity, but in a sense, it's just a largeness within which that specificity sits. You know, if you listen to Paul Kingsnorth or Martin Shaw describe their beliefs, their actual doctrinal beliefs, they're very orthodox or evangelical even. But I for myself, I just think what they bring, and more generally what the Orthodox brings, is this larger dimension of Christian experience to the body of Christ as a whole. And it's very rich. This still leaves us with the question that, you know, you asked or you touched on earlier, like, okay, but why have some of these elites gripped? They've been gripped by Christianity. They haven't taken the leap. And I want to use this to touch on a couple things that I think are important about that come up against maybe some of the worries or concerns about Christianity that not only non-Christians, but even some Christians have, which is, well, yeah, at the end of the day, you know, Christians have squabbled over parts of the Bible for centuries, you know, so ultimately, is it really something we can go to? Is it really something we can rely on? And therefore, is the testimony about God given to us within the Bible reliable? I want to touch on that. But firstly, I think it would be helpful to hear from a biblical text, again, from one of Paul's letters that speaks to this. So this is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 18 to 25. For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will bring to nothing. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the clever debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God, through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, and Greeks desire wisdom. But we proclaim the Messiah crucified, which is a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, the Messiah is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. When Paul says, for Jews demand signs and Greeks desire wisdom, but we proclaim Messiah crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, I think we could easily replace that with broader language to say that the crucified Jesus is a stumbling block to the religious and foolishness to those who pride themselves, in a sense, in their intellect. And so what I want to reflect on in closing here is, and this touches both on the Bible itself, but then also on our encounter with God more generally. And so let's start with the Bible. You know, there's this critique of the Bible. It's a clearly human document, and Christians believe that. We say it is humans, but under the inspiration of God, are writing this out. But it's very human. It includes typos. And we all know that. There's no scholar who would deny that the Bible contains a well, they're not typographical because of the time they were writing by hand, but, you know, copying errors and things like that are there. One manuscript might have a verse here and the other manuscript has the verse over there. But these are quite minor, you know, inconsistencies, you could say, within the text. It has deeper challenges, though. It can be very hard to read at times. In other places, it seems to be very clear in what it's saying. As we talked about earlier, there's places in the Bible, like in parts of the Old Testament, parts of the New Testament, that are extremely literarily sophisticated. And sometimes the gap between us and understanding the Bible is simply that we have to do a lot of hard work to learn how the culture of the time thought and wrote, and then learn that, and then it's easier for us to understand. But there are still parts of Scripture that are elusive for us. We can't quite pin them down. And generation after generation after generation of Christian thinkers continue to do the work of theology precisely because of this, you know, and wrestle with things. I think what's important in this is to understand, I believe, that God has actually given us a text that is in human form in such a way that it's relatable, it's something that we can enter into, but at the same time, he's not going to allow us to domesticate it. He has not given us a revelation of himself that we can, you know, like a manual that you can memorize and have it all figured out and parsed and understood. And I think that Christians need to understand that. It's a gift to us because it means that we have to remain in our place of the natural limitations that we have, which is, I don't just mean the limitations of our minds and so on, but the greater limitation, we're not God. And if we try to be God, that's immediately entering into the problems that drive the harmful things that happen in our world. So what I'm saying is that Scripture, if we understand it for what it is actually forcing us into a posture of humility before its authority and away from our own authority. And if its weirdness and its occasional obscurity or seeming contradictions push us to reject its authority, well, okay, if that's a decision you want to make, that's a decision you want to make, but it actually still leaves you with a problem. And that is that you are stuck deeper than ever in the fact you have to depend on your own authority, which we already know is very limited. But beyond that, if we come back to this challenge of the leap, you know, that somebody who's exploring Christianity but maybe comes up against these gaps that they're struggling to jump across, that feels like an abandonment of reason, perhaps. Tom Holland has said it openly. I think Jordan Peterson has said it openly, that to actually believe in the resurrection, that's a big leap for them to make. But I think what has happened is that God has put us in what is ultimately the pride challenging situation of having to deal again with what we're saying just now, a grubby, strange story of his people that culminates in this crucifixion and resurrection of his son, Jesus. And the power of this is that God has come in our direction. That's actually what's beautiful about this story is that God has come in our direction. But we don't like it because it's happened in a way that challenges our willingness to, or challenges our need to have it all figured out, that we fully understand things. And I would say that for us to fully enter into who God is and what he has for us, that's what we actually have to leave behind. So yes, is there a leap of faith that we have to make if we're going to put our trust in Jesus? Yes. But it's not the abandonment of reason per se. It is a leap past the limits of reason to acknowledge I can't gain intellectual control of this matter because I'm trying to gain control of God. And so in the end, I have to take this crazy move of accepting a resurrection, but also beyond that, accepting this upside down witness of a messy church and its complicated Bible, which is ultimately means I'm relinquishing self-will. I'm relinquishing the right to self-adjudicate what is true or not true.
Yeah. And thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation, Jonathan. I've really enjoyed kind of being able to sketch out some of the contours of how these different people and what's going on in our culture, syncs up with the way the Bible sort of looks at humans and human history and so on. I'd agree with everything you said, really. The Bible, in a sense, is weird, and we should keep it weird. You know, in fact, that's partly what's attracting people to Christianity is its weirdness. It is different to the kind of contemporary culture and what it offers. And it was weird when it first began, 2,000 years ago. Christians were very weird for this belief that God has become human, God himself crucified, died the death of a rebel slave. I mean, the worst possible outcome for any God you could imagine. And then apparently had claimed to have risen again. And the things that they said about what that meant for their community were completely weird, that now there was neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female. It was like this complete different change. It was weird. A lot of those things now are not weird because, as we've said, they've become so much part of our culture anyway, this idea of human equality and dignity and so on. And so the challenge, I think, as Tom Holland has said to me, is how do we keep Christianity weird in the sense? How do we keep it, actually something that actually stands out and makes a difference in the culture? And I think that's something that we'll need to do in that sense. I absolutely want us to he, you know, celebrate almost the weirdness of the Bible. You know, this is a book that has a long history. And if it only spoke perfectly to us and our culture, that would be very strange, because then it wouldn't speak to any other culture in the past. Yet it has spoken across many different places, times and cultures throughout history. There's something rather remarkable about that, even given all everything you said about, you know, the human aspect of the Bible, of course. It still seems to have this divine imprint that seems to have allowed it to transform whole cultures. And that for me is pretty remarkable. And that's something I think a lot of people, even secular people, are waking up to these days, that actually there's something remarkable. There's something weird about the Christian story, about the way it's portrayed in the Bible, and most especially about the person at the center of it. Because whatever your views on the Bible are, it ultimately is about revealing to us the personal word of God, Jesus Christ. And for me, he is the center of history. And I think even as atheists and secularists have tried to change that story, wipe that off the map, it somehow comes back again, that, that Jesus Christ is at the center of it all.
Well, Justin, this has been a fantastic conversation. Well, I hope that for listeners, this has done, well, many things, but in particular has shown that Christianity is not just an intellectually viable option, it is perhaps the most profound option to consider. But also, to come back to what we began with in the podcast, we've seen secularism as kind of this pretty much unassailable power or authority in our culture, and Christianity can't get past it. It's too strong. It's smart. It's scientific. It's rational. And I hope that this podcast has shown that those things aren't true, and that the power of God is still what it has always been, something that transforms our lives, transforms our cultures. And for those who care about science, which includes me, science has a place in that, but it's not God. It's not King. Well, Justin, thank you for joining us for this episode. It's been fantastic.
Thank you for the opportunity, Jonathan. It was a delight.
This brings us to the end of this episode. If you are enjoying this podcast or others at Ziwani, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. It helps to spread the word and to get more listening. Please be sure to come back in 2 weeks for the next episode. Until then, this is goodbye from me, Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.